today we talk to, well, me, Benny, on Chris Lamsam Asking Benny Questions. Benny Asking People Questions is proudly supported by Major Minor Music Australia, who wish to thank the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation on whose lands we meet here today and do all our work. Always was, always will be. If you'd like to know more, then head along to mmma.com.au.
Welcome, dear listeners, to another magical episode of Benny Asking People Questions. Except this is the special episode we've all been waiting for. The one where the talkative tables are turned on the podcast creator himself and someone else gets to ask Benny questions. For those of you curious about the non-Australian voice talking to you right now, my name is Chris Lamsam. I'm a New Zealand-based musician for children who has been interviewed on this podcast previously, and I'm also a great friend, supporter, and admirer of the man we'll be hearing from today. I'm beyond thrilled today because we finally get to hear from the man behind the podcast after a whopping 50 episodes he has recorded and released since March 2020. The maestro of melodies, producer of poems, unifier of musical universes, and a true luminary in the world of children's music, Mr. Benny Thatcher. Now, for those of you who already know Benny, you're likely accustomed to the joyous tunes and tales that have become part of the soundtrack of countless childhoods. But prepare yourselves to discover the person behind the music, because today I'm on a mission to peel back the layers, to uncover the inspirations, challenges, and extraordinary creativity that makes Benny the musical magic maker so many of us adore. In every note and lyric, Benny weaves a tapestry of enchantment that captures the hearts of both the young and the young at heart. Today we embark on a delightful journey exploring the whimsical landscapes of Benny's imagination and the profound impact this incredible artist and human has made on the world of children's music. So without further ado, let's dive into the mirth and music of Benny Thatcher. Get ready to be captivated, inspired, and utterly charmed as we unravel the musical marvel behind the melodies. Benny, welcome to your own show.
All right, that was worth waiting 50 episodes for. Has it really been 50 episodes? Is that true?
50? Yeah. Wow. I had to keep clicking. Can I see 10 more episodes? Can I see 10 more episodes on the
wow.
list? And then when I got to 50, I went, I don't want to see any more episodes because this guy's done so many.
Well, I had no. Thank you. And look. Thank you very much for the introduction. And I now understand why everyone feels desperately uncomfortable when I do them because they're just going, oh, really? I feel like I've got a lot to live up to now. Or maybe that's the point. Maybe that's why the introduction's there in the first place, right?
But they're very important. I am looking forward to you moving into your career as a biographer. That will be really special.
Oh, that's a good, yeah. I don't think anyone's really documenting the children's world like that, are they? The music for children? Okay, there you go.
Well you are. You've got a good head start. Yeah.
I'm going to go and start a whole new thing.
Benny, let's kick off, all right? We're going to start understanding who you are and what you do and why you do what you do. I want to start right back at the beginning. Let's go back in time. Where did you grow up and what sort of things did you like to do as a child?
As a child. So I grew up in Sydney, Australia. And within Sydney, there's this particular area called the Shire. And it's, I actually think, well, it's the Sutherland Shire, but it also got called the Shire as a little bit of a nod to Tolkien, way pre-movies and everything, because it's quite a, it's an area of Sydney that is not a huge fan of change. And it's not a huge fan of different things. It's a very lovely area, and I do need to be careful because I've sort of matured a lot now. I like to think I have. And so I guess a lot of my childhood angst isn't quite there anymore. But it wasn't the kind of place that I felt I was comfortable. So you had to play rugby league, you had to surf, you had to do all those kind of things, which I did. I did dutifully, and I don't know. I think I did them to the best of my ability, whether that means that was the best of everyone else's ability, but I did them. But it wasn't the kind of area where the school had a music class, but very, very minimal and run and not supported. I went to an all-boys public school, My primary school was beautiful. It was Warranora, and it was just this little valley that sort of exists down there. That they've now built this huge big highway that goes over the top of the valley, which kind of just makes it even more beautiful now because you can only get there if you live there. That's the only reason you'd be traveling there. And everyone lives on these really quiet waterfronts. And I had all these friends that got to school. They could only travel to school via boat. That was our only mode of transport. So yeah, my life was around the Shire. Which was lovely. It's a lovely place, but I don't feel it was me. I don't feel it was probably the best place for all my world queries. I'm not sure if it was the best location. But you know, I learned what I needed to learn and I left when I was able to leave and you know, there's some people I still keep in touch with from school, not a huge amount. Facebook makes it all the more easier. So yeah, and I grew up in an area called Oyster Bay, which sounds even more idyllic. And we lived, I know everyone's like, really, you're complaining about you grew up in a place that people could only travel to by water and then you lived in Oyster Bay, like, give me a break. And there was a big creek down the end of the road and my brother and I used to go down there and catch eels with tongs. We'd take the tongs from the drawers of the kitchen and we'd go down there and catch eels. And I remember this one particular time we saw an eel under a rock. My brother grabbed it and he started pulling it out. And this eel was really, 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 really uncomfortably long. And it just kept getting longer and longer and longer. And then less black and definitely more brown, this eel. And then very quickly we realized it was absolutely not an eel. And he'd had a brown snake in these tongs. And he had the head of the brown snake in the tong. And I remember just seeing his hand just go white because he was just crushing so hard because he was terrified. And me being like a huge protector of my older brother, I just legged it. I just ran as fast as I could at the top of this hill and just shouted, just drop it. You know, like, easy for me to say. Anyway, he dropped it and ran. And I think the last thing I remember is just seeing this snake. And I think out of all of us, the snake was really the one that had no idea what was going on the most. It just sat in the water. And I think I could actually, I've never seen a snake blink, but I really clearly remember this one just dazed and blinking, going, what the? And then it just meandered back under its rock. And I think that might, and you know what? That might have been the end of our tong eel catching days.
There's a tree in my street. It grows so very tall. I climb to the top and look down on the world. And everything that once was big is now so tiny and small. Here up above it all. And I could be the queen. A hungry dog.
There's aspects of it that were really, really wonderful, but I guess if you wanted to pursue art and you wanted to pursue creativity, whether it be music, anything, it just kind of wasn't really the place to do it. There wasn't a lot of diversity. It was what it was. And yeah, lots of really hard working middle class people. And yeah, so that was just an enormously small snippet of my upbringing.
So what I hear is a distinct lack of music and arts really influencing you around that time, from those enormously small stories. Perhaps there's something else going on in the background you haven't alluded to that was an inspirational starting point for your joy for music.
I think there's a couple of things. So my parents separated when I was quite young, when I was about three or four, and I lived with my father. So I grew up with my dad in the Oyster Bay house with my older brother and sister. And my mother moved in closer to the city. And my mother's terribly eclectic person, and my dad's high, he's, you know, big intellect. He's a doctor in astrophysics, that kind of intellect. Yeah. And very Christian, and he still is. And so I think what kind of happened is I sort of spent my time with my father, not strict, but it was a very Christian upbringing. And then time with my mother was spent, that was kind of, and I use the term with endearment, but that was where the chaos was. And, mum would do things like sneak me into jazz bars at like 7. She'd put me under a coat and sneak me in, and she'd
Wow.
sit me, yeah, and she'd sneak me in and sit me around the corner with the other band, because her partner at the time was a clarinet player, clarinetist, clarinetist, netist,
Netus.
netist. And so they knew all the band members. So I would go to these old jazz clubs in Sydney. The name there was like Soup Plus and the Basement, back when it was still a basement. And I'd be plonked in the corner and sit with these musicians, while mum would go and have a just, yeah, go and listen to music and dance and hang out with people. And I think often what happened is sometimes the musicians were a bit like, who's this kid? So they would kind of come and sit with me and I guess just make me go, hey man, like you're right. But then, to be fair, so mum was always surrounded by musicians, and so there was always elements of this one particular gentleman, the clarinetist. He was like also an audio aficionado. So he had these massive speakers that were just made of fabric and things like this. And he also had this when he was younger, so we're now talking 50s. He did a jazz pilgrimage through Europe and America and took an old reel-to-reel recorder with him. And every thing he went to, he would set up these. And also being a bit of an audio nerd, he wouldn't just plonk a mic at the front. He'd set up a few. And so he had like hundreds of these reel-to-reel recordings of really truly genuine jazz greats at the start of their career. Like it was sort of bordering on priceless.
Our next guest has come a long way from teaching, and today he swaps his chalk for a guitar.
Here with us tonight, all the way from Sydney, Australia, put your hands together for
Benny Time!
Man, I gotta tell you, cars are everywhere. Cars are everywhere, man. In that parking lot. You see some.
So there was him, and then when they separated, mum ended up with a guitarist that, the fabric speakers moved out, and then in came this wall-to-wall amplifiers. So I think it was always around. My father, on the other hand, is he would. He's got quite an eclectic taste, and so he'd really love just really strange bands and things. He didn't have a lot of choice, but the ones he chose are always a little bit random. However, in amongst that, there was no real from neither of them really. There was no invitation really to be part of it or be excited by it. It was just kind of that was their life. And so it was just kind of around, and look, obviously, in hindsight, it's pretty clear that had an impact. But yeah, I think quite early on, I remember music being something I used to disappear. I mean, it's like a lot of us, I heard Sgt. Pepper's and just kind of went, well, that's all I need now. And I think I was 12, and then I heard Blackbird. And then when I heard Blackbird, I, along with every other guitarist in the world, I just ran outside and hacked down a tree and built a guitar so I could learn that song immediately. And then after doing that for about a month, I went, well, I'll go actually get a guitar, because the tree, I mean, it was just a stick. It wasn't any good as a guitar.
Mountain standing tall watches the river. Says hello to river as it rolls. wonders how it feels to move so free, so strong, to the sea where it belongs.
Yeah, so I think it was a case of like it was around me, but it was never, it was, you know, even when I was getting guitar lessons, I got them from my mum's partner, who I think she'd married by this stage, actually. So it was her second husband. It was a very, very quick marriage. But, you know, it wasn't necessarily, it wasn't disallowed by my dad, but it wasn't, sort of wasn't supported. When I'd go for the lessons, it wasn't like mum was actually there at the house. So I'd just go and he'd be there and we'd have a lesson. I'd sleep on the couch and get up and go to school the next morning. So it was definitely what I do remember in hindsight is it was around me, but it was definitely me pursuing the involvement in it. It was always me really going, I want to know more about that. I want to know more about that. I need to know more about that. So, yeah.
Amazing. So you've had music around you and you've chosen to step into that realm as often as you could. Hmm. And it's great to hear the influence of the Beatles there, obviously very influential on so many young musicians around the time they were releasing that music. I wonder, Benny, do you have a moment when you kind of realized that music was something that you wanted to keep as part of your life?
I think there were several times when I realized music was just more than a song, I guess. And weirdly, some of my real, and which I do think I you can hear in my music now, but one of my biggest musical influences without question was Monty Python. And their audio albums. So they release a whole bunch of, and I remember in year 12 when you get those year 12 folders that you'd carry around, everyone's putting Guns N' Roses and stuff on theirs. And I turned up with the Beatles, Monty Python, Woody Allen, you know. And oddly, in hindsight, no one actually picked on me, which was really quite amazing considering the school I went to. But, you know, I didn't have a single picture of a girl in a bikini on my folder, and I think that was, in hindsight, might have been the only kid in the year that didn't. But I remember those albums. I mean, the Beatles, obviously, I mean, you know, I think all of us can talk about the Beatles forever, but I remember the Monty Python albums I just inhaled. I love the movies, but the albums just absolutely blew my brain because I'd never heard anyone create such a world using nothing but sounds, in particular with, I remember getting the album of, Holy Grail, and it starts with, it's like they're playing the film and it's the opening night of the film, and it starts with all this big car crash that starts pretty funny. It's all these things like Roger Moore flying through a windscreen. It's hysterical. But then they go, and then they say, okay, the movie starts. And for those of you that remember, and for those of you that don't, it starts off with, what's I can't remember his name. It's Graham Chapman playing King Arthur. King Arthur comes up and there's coconuts. The clip-clop of the horse, and it's the coconuts. But the film's, and he comes up with clapping the coconuts, and then Graham Chapman, as King Arthur, says, "Whoa there!" And when he says it, the whole audience erupts in laughter. This obviously just recorded laughter. And the commentator's like, "Oh, yes, very funny visual gag there. Probably wasn't that great for you at home listening, but very funny." And I remember just thinking, oh my God, that's funnier than the movie. Like somehow you've made that thing, which is iconic now and hysterical, you've made it so much funnier. And I just, those albums to me just, and then they just seamlessly go into a song that were really well written. I mean, Eric Idle just wrote really amazing songs. And I used to be thinking, how can we do one a year and it's that good? But But those albums for me, I really do generally believe I heard those and just all of a sudden went, oh, it's kind of anything's really possible. There's no real, it's whatever you want to do is really that's what I learned from that. Beatles, you learn about just harmonies, bass, all that sort of stuff as you do like young musicians. But Monty Python really just made me go, it's just open to whatever you want. There's no rules on what you want to put out there. And I think that was really exciting for me.
I went to the zoo to visit the Gnu, but was a little sad to find that this beautiful creature stood as a feature in a room no bigger than mine. Oh, but it was terribly exciting and hardly surprising when out of its cage it climbed, and it gave me a wink, or at least that's what I think, as it trotted off back to the wild.
And how wonderful is that to discover then and then see that coming through in your albums as well, because there are so many genres across all of your albums. There are so many places that you take your listeners, and I think that's so evidently clear. So you've clearly taken that with you throughout your recording career, which is lovely. And as you know, children's musicians get to play in any genre they want to, because if we're writing music for children, there aren't no set rules around what children's music has to sound like.
No, and it's funny, I can really pick people that are Monty Python fans. Like, I remember listening to the Listies, and when I was doing an interview with them, and I was going back listening to all their stuff, and there was this moment, and I went, they're Python people. There's something they do, and it's really strange. Like, you need to be a Python person to know a Python person. And in the podcast, I remember making quite an obscure reference to Python that Rich got immediately, and I just went, yeah, you can really hear it. There's a real lunacy. But it's not. I remember interviewing Peter Coombe and talking to him about this idea of just really crafted. I can't remember the exact term, but the really crafted lunacy and chaos in what you create. And look, do I get that every time? I don't think I get it every time, but I try to get it in there every time, because there's so much fun when you take madness so seriously and sensibly, when you approach madness with such consideration. I just think that's where you can do everything serious. You know, you can write a serious song and be serious, and you can go to it being serious. But when you go to something that you know in your heart is just total madness, and you give it just as much sincere love and attention that you would give anything else, it's so liberating. I mean, look, the obvious example of that for me is He Needs to Wee is probably the culmination of that, so of that whole concept of just, you know, I remember talking to Mike and we did it, and he said, oh, what about we try this and try this? And I said, look, I'm not really fussed about what we do in the verses. I said, but that chorus, it needs, and it was the first time I hired a person to write the choral piece. I kind of feel I probably could have done it, but this particular person, Laura, who her last name escapes me at the moment, my deepest apologies, she, you know, that's what she does. She writes choral pieces. And I just went, it's got to be so insanely exact and big and huge. Otherwise this whole song doesn't mean anything. And I don't know. I think it's present in what I do. I think it's present in everything I do. It's the idea of just going, oh, how insane can I be while everyone's taking it really seriously. I find a lot of joy in that. And that's Monty Python. Absolutely thrilled.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. I need to wee. I need to wee. I look around on Mars and cannot find a tree. I need to wee. Yeah, I need to wee. I'll have to sit and bring together both my knees. Oh, man, I really need to wee.
Oh, come on.
Fascinating. We had no connection before you talked about this, about that. But I love what you're saying about taking the madness seriously. I think that's a really beautiful thing. And it makes me think of the Python's colleagues at the time, you know, the Goons and Spike Milligan and Peter Sellers and all of those guys that had sort of even done things before them to inspire John Cleese and Eric Idle. There's that silliness that comes through, particularly from British humour.
That's children's lives. I mean, like, children, play is so damn important to children. It's when they're having fun, it's really serious work. It's really serious work. And I think, you know, it took a long while for the world to catch on to the whole learning through play kind of idea, but just it's that madness, that chaos, it's really important to children, and it's important to treat it importantly.
Love that. Benny, you are an early childhood educator. It's something that you've been passionate about for many, many years. And obviously, it's so beautiful to hear children's voice in your music, listening through your albums and hearing little people talk and speak and sing with you. It's just so delightful. When did you decide to get into early childhood education?
So, having just left the Shire, I got a job in an accounting firm, and it was in the, this is 92, and it was one of the...
Unexpected, yes.
Yes, very terribly unexpected. But it was one of the big five. I don't know if anyone out there remembers that stuff, but I think before they all merged. So it was like Coopers and Librand and Pete Marwick and Price Waterhouse and all that kind of stuff. And I worked for one of them called KPMG, so Pete Marwick essentially. And massive, huge company, and I worked in a very rudimentary position. But, you know, again, I spent the whole day running around in my socks, and this was back in the day where every month I'd have to go through and photocopy, so we had backup copies of all the invoicing they'd done that month. So there'd be days where I'd just spend 2 days in the photocopy room, and I'd stick my name tag up there, and I just thought it was hysterical, and isn't it amazing? And I got in trouble all the time for it. And I remember they came to me and said, look, what do you want to do with your life? And I was like, I don't know, man. Like, I'm 19. It's like this at the moment. I want to do this because it's hysterical. And they said, because, you know, we're going to offer you a, what are they called when they put you through university? They pay for you and they do all that kind of stuff. It's very, very formal and very... corporate, I can't remember the word, but they were going to pay for me to they were going to put me through accounting, pay for it, and set me up and groom me to be one of the many partners of the firm. Which,
an apprenticeship?
No, it's like a cadetship
internship
kind of thing.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Sort of, because we were talking in the 90s, so different terminology back then. People didn't work for free back in the 90s for internships. That's a whole new invention. But and I remember I just remember going, that's just the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Why on earth would you put that kind of faith in me? That's just insane. Like, it really, to me, it was just, I remember it was the manager and the partner of this particular department at the time had the very formal meeting with me. And I remember just looking at these two men going, what's wrong with you? Like, why on earth would you choose me? This is just ridiculous. And they said, go home and think about it. And I went home, and I think just for a laugh, I just wrote a resignation letter and went back the next day and handed it to them. I said, I've thought about it. I resign.
I love it.
Yeah, and they had another emergency meeting and said, you haven't really thought this through. You've got to really think about your career. And I'm just like going, and I was, the whole time, though, in my head, I was going, what is wrong? I also worked in this huge department of women. And I was also going, I was the only guy, and I'm like going, there's a lot of really capable people out there that actually enjoy this and take it seriously. This is just all a bit wrong. This is, I'm not, you know. So I quit and gave 2 weeks. And I think every day they're like, when are you coming, you know, you've got to think about this. I've thought about it. I really have thought
I'm
about
leaving.
it. This is ridiculous. I'm leaving. And so I left. And then the next day, a friend of mine who was a director in an early childhood centre rang me and said, "Can you come in and just do a casual day? I've heard you just quit your job." So I think my dad had told everyone at church because he was like, "Ben just got offered this." Like, I remember he was so
Someone
excited.
please
He
rescue
was
him.
so excited when I told him they offered me this thing. Like, I mean, poor dad. He
Wow.
was so excited about it. Because I think there was always hopes that I'd do quite well at uni and all that sort of stuff. And then I got my HSC results back. And I think that all disappeared quite quickly. And so I think in his mind, he was like, "Oh my goodness, this is one of the biggest firms in the world." And they've offered him a career. And you know, he can't keep his shoes on. So this is amazing. And then I went in and quit, and he was really devastated. So my friend I woke up in the morning and just went, "Oh," which I've done my whole life. I'm not great at planning. And then my friend just rang me and she said, "Can you come do a casual day?" And I went, "Yeah, sure. What do I have to do?" And she goes, "Well, you just got to come and stop kids joking, basically." And I was like, "All right." So I turned up to this childcare center, and man, I walked in the door and just no one had shoes on. And everyone,
You found your people.
it was a
You've
bit
gone
like
back to
that.
the
I
Shire where
just
everyone was little.
walked in. Exactly. I was like, how come I should have grown up with you people? Which I probably did. I kept growing. And yeah, I really just walked in and went, "Oh, wow, well, this is amazing." So I went and immediately studied and did started my diploma at the time. That was kind of the only childcare course you could do. But at this stage, music was becoming quite strong in me. So I sort of went, "It's not something I'm going to do for my whole life. It will be my job. So I don't really want to go and study, because what I will do is be a hugely famous, successful, you know, person in a punk band." But yeah, that was the start, and 30 years later, still doing it, and have done multiple versions of it since.
If I were the boss of it all, if I were the boss of it all, I'd go to bed really late and I wouldn't pack away at all. I'd never clean my teeth or put shoes on my feet. I'd never eat a single vegetable, and I wouldn't even use a plate. If I were the boss of it all, I'd
That
probably
that's a
change the
fascinating journey
rules.
to get to where you ended up.
One
I
person
don't know if any of us
person
listening would have
in
been able to
every
predict
family chooses.
any of that.
I don't think if anybody listening would ever believe me if I said I don't like talking about myself either. I think that's the thing. Like, I feel really uncomfortable about this. Do you really? It's like, nah, it's kind of fun. Anyway,
We're
next
almost
question.
at a batch of questions, which are really important to me, which is gonna we're gonna dig down into your process. But what I'd love to do just before we do that is link you working in early childhood to you becoming the children's songwriter. What was that link?
So obviously I'm doing music the whole time. And because that's what I did. So I'd play gigs at night, then go and work with children in the day, because that was when I was young and had the energy. And then I met Joe years later, my
Yes.
amazing Joe. Now, in this time, just before I met Joe, I started studying and doing a Bachelor of Music. So I started doing a Bachelor of Music, and at that time was to do that was working at my brother's mechanical workshop. So I was a mechanic for about 4 years, fixing cars. And I was doing that while I was studying. And then Jo, my beautiful wife Jo, is a television producer. And at this particular time, she was one of the producers on a film with a gentleman by the name of David Elphick. For those of you that don't know David Elphick, he's one of the producers of Rabbit Proof Fence and has made a lot of very seminal films over here. And he's quite an amazing guy. And at the time, he said, "Oh, I'm going to pitch this show. He said to Joe, can Benny write some kids' songs? So she came home and asked me, and I went, yeah, sure. So I did I Can Be Any Animal, I think, was one of them, and then something else. And then and they gave it to him. And I think there was this moment where we all just kind of went, they're kind of not bad, actually. Like, I think for this this little crappy pilot we're putting together, these are, and you know, they're actually all right. So we did the show. And then while I was – and then I traveled with Joe over to the UK because she was working on the MOBO Awards, which are the Music of Black Origin over there. And so I just basically went over and did – was working a couple of days a week in London in a childcare center. And while I was there, I got a phone call from David who said, the gentleman that paid for this one in Singapore runs all these childcare centers, and he saw you and he wants to film a pilot for an episode for you to be in. And I was like, hang on, I should put shoes on for this. So I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, you remember that idea you told me about group time? And I was like, yeah, it's just me sitting with kids playing things. Anyway, he loves it and wants to film film 10 episodes in Singapore. Do you want to come to Singapore on your way back to Australia? And I went, oh, sure, okay. So I went back there. So Joe was meant to come with us, and as we went to get on the plane, they said, oh, your passport expires.
No.
In under 6 months, so you can't go to Singapore. So all of a sudden I just went to Singapore on my own. And I think Joe was secretly quite happy about that. and so we did that, but I had to write 10 songs for the 10 episodes. So I just busily wrote them in the UK and then in London, and then went to Singapore, and then just did an episode a song basically, and then came back. And look, I'll be honest with you, this show's not amazing. But I came back with all these songs, and then I just kind of went, oh, I should probably do this and record them. And I did. And that was it. That was what a beautiful day.
That was in 2015. What a great album.
What a beautiful day for singing a song. What a beautiful day. Sing along with me. All our friends are here. The sun is shining.
Again, the incredibly short version of how that all happened. It's all quite random, really, if I look back at it.
It is. It feels like the universe knew what it wanted from you, but you didn't.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever known. I think it's only really been in the last 4 years that the world is quite clear to me, and it really hasn't been before. And looking back to the stories like that, I kind of go, yeah, I don't think I ever really had. It's funny, this one sidesteps. So this gentleman from Singapore, when we came back, David said to me, this gentleman would like, we're going to do a big stage show, and I was hoping you could be in it, and this other performer who was a high school presenter that David had worked with, and they said, oh, you're going to write it with Peter Dasent. And I, at the time, I didn't know much about Peter. He said, well, he's a play school pianist. And I was like, oh, my goodness. So I went and met Peter. And then we had a time when I met Arthur Basting as well and had a songwriting session with the two of them. I think in hindsight, I now realize just how extraordinarily fortunate that is. But at the time, I guess I didn't. But then I started really questioning the guy that was funding it. I really didn't quite like his attitude towards children, and I didn't really think it was the best thing for someone that believed passionately in the education. I didn't think this was something I really felt comfortable putting my name to. So I actually did eventually say, look, I'm really sorry. I don't think I can do this. Like, I just don't feel comfortable. And I felt really bad at the time because I couldn't quite work out what I was just being a bit of a angry young man, but clearly like in my late 30s. But I didn't know if it was like an angry young man call or if it was a genuine. I couldn't really work it out because the other two were much older and wise. David's an incredibly wise man. Peter Dasent, who you've met, he's just next level wise and clever. So I was a bit like, am I just being a bit? Anyway, cut to only just 2 weeks ago, I had a meeting with someone about a children's book that I'm hoping to release. And she said to me, I said, look, blah, 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 blah. I was doing the usual pitching myself. And she said, look, she goes, I'm just going to stop you there. That day you decided not to do that show, she said, I remember that. And that to me was the biggest testament of character you could ever give me. She goes, and that was like 10 years ago.
Wow.
Mm. And it was kind of funny because that once I sort of pulled out, everyone started going, actually, you know what, this is all a bit, we don't really want to do this. For different reasons for me, but whatever the relationship was, I don't know. But that was for me. I was just like, I'm not a huge fan of what's this is happening. And but yeah, she said, you know, that to me was a real, you know, testament of character. And so I don't need to know that you have integrity. And I was like, I don't think I was drunk. I don't remember saying it. Anyway.
Wow, that's super special that someone remembers that moment. You were like, why am I doing this? It doesn't feel right, but I'm doing it.
Yeah, exactly. I don't even know what your question was. What was the question?
No, it was you know, what was the bridge between you working in early childhood and then you starting to write songs? And I think you've shown us those opportunities just coming out of nowhere.
That's what it is. Yeah, there'd never been a plan. Like, and then going back to that thing with the conversation with this person recently, I was just kind of going, who'd have thought that thing that happened 10 years ago would prove to actually weirdly be incredibly essential now. And I kind of get the sense that's what my life's a bit like. Imagine what would happen if I concentrated a bit more on all these moments, right?
Well, to be fair, Benny, I think you've been concentrating a lot in the last few years. We'll get to that very soon. I feel like since 2015, we've seen a really great pattern, a prolific pattern of production. If you don't mind my alliteration there, I think you've been very, very epic. And it's been a great pleasure for me in the last few days to really be going through your albums chronologically and listening to your style. And just realizing too how settled you were in your style from album one. There are things that I love about the collaboration you were using in those times, the genre jumping you were doing in the first album, that have really just followed you all the way through. And I don't know if we can talk about the exciting new album which is coming out soon, but even in the demos that I've heard from that, I can hear just a really, really grounded musician working with all the colors that he could possibly want to work with, really proficiently and for the benefit of children. So I think what you've landed on in the last 10 years is something pretty special, and it seems very, very established, and you're very confident in what you're doing.
Thank you. That's very kind, because I kind of feel there's elements of the first album I'm not embarrassed about, but I don't, you know, you'd sort of cringe about. But what's strange is I don't cringe about any of it musically. I think the music. Like, I think I knew what I've always wanted to do from the get-go. What I cringe about is just now what I know about children and music and what they can really cope with. And you can see that, particularly in the last one, the demos that you've heard. I think the one that's coming falls a bit more back into just that child-esque world. It's very simple. It's about everything in my backyard. But just lyrically, it's very different to how I would have treated it 10, you know, 9, 8 years ago. And I think what has grown in me is just understanding, I think recognizing what my strength is in the genre as well. I kind of, for a while there, called myself the gap filler. And I think a lot of people would misunderstand. They would sort of go, oh, you know, don't dismiss yourself. And I actually wasn't. dismissing myself. What I was saying was, is for me, and it really hit the second album, I looked around and just went, what's not being made for children? What's being left out? And whether it worked or whether or not anyone paid attention to it or not, I felt my position or my job was to remind people this is not being done. And it's funny, I now think with my last album, with the one that you've heard, which I have no idea when that'll be coming out, and I don't know what it's called. I think it's called My Garden or something.
It's beautiful.
Thank you. I feel it's me going back to actually just going, oh, I just kind of want to have a bit of fun with kids.
Mm.
Whereas obviously the last album, Benny and Friends, was really me going, I want to collaborate till it makes me sick. I want to work with everyone I can possibly work with, and I don't care how big or hard it can be, because of yourself and the people you surround yourself with. I saw it happening in New Zealand, and I just saw the strength of what was happening over there because everyone worked together. And I looked at our landscape and went, you know what? It's not as prevalent. It's prevalent on the YouTube and things like that, where people are kind of leaning on each other's skill, you know, followers and things like that, which I have zero issue with. That's what that is. But it wasn't happening the way that it was happening in New Zealand, and wasn't having the music that was coming out of your country just really floored me. And every time I interviewed, you know, I think Lucy was the first one that reached out, and I went, oh, great. You know, oh, somebody in New Zealand, how exciting. And sort of listened and went, wow, this is really quite extraordinary. And also seeing how everyone's lives, you didn't, there's less of everyone separating themselves from what they do. Like, it's not like, oh, here's my adult thing and here's my kid's thing and I don't, you know, no. And I just saw what, you know, then she'd say, oh, you should talk to my friend Chris. I'll do an intro. And then I'd listen to your music and go, oh, my goodness. And then I found Claudia. And then it just never ended. Everyone I spoke to. And then just talking to Robin Nathan the other day, Fleabite. I was about to say Fleabag then, but that's definitely wrong.
Definitely Fleabite.
Yeah. And, you know, there's just this entire year of her life is just writing with other people.
Mm.
And that, going back to that gap filler thing, I looked at that album and just went, what's missing in our musical landscape? And for me, what was missing was just that real genuine sharing of, it wasn't missing, it just hadn't been ignited yet, I think. So missing as in, I don't think we're conscious that it wasn't available. It just wasn't something that was lent on. I really not doing great at answering the questions. I'm just kind of talking.
It's fine, Benny. It's fine. People, I'm sure, will be hanging on your every word. I just wanted to say, though, as much as you're sort of speaking to the lack of collaboration in the music that was happening in your beautiful country, Australia, the What a Beautiful Day album, you get to track 8 and the whole album sort of takes a beautiful turn. You get to the beautiful song, There's a Tree in My Street with Angie Hart, and you start hearing a different voice on your album for the first time. And then the next 8 songs or 7 songs on that album are pretty much all massive collaboration with different genres and bands. And it's almost like you just lift the lid halfway through and go, actually, this is what's been hiding. If you're still with me here, now we get to party. And it goes. And then that vibe doesn't stop in the next albums, with the exception of Stories and Poems, which is you reading beautiful poetry and prose. And I want to get into that in a second. But there's always someone else happening on the album in the back, even in the background, you can hear that you've got instrumentalists soloing. this thing about collaboration is something that I wanted to dig down into, because you've been doing it for a while, even before you met everyone from New Zealand who seemed to be, in your words, doing more and whatever. I think you were perhaps the original, the OG collaborator in the children's music scene in Australia, certainly the more independent one. And that, I think, is highlighted so beautifully at the beginning of Benny and Friends, when the first track is the Do song, and everyone who's anyone turns up at your door and does a song with you. And I'm just thinking, this guy is showing everyone how it's done. This is how we build a family in an industry. We invite
it's also literally how you build a song with all these people.
Exactly. You right. And I'm listening to that just going, all right, this guy is really cementing himself as the unifier of universes, as I said in my introduction, because it really was refreshing to hear that someone had jumped across the boundaries between brands and wrapped their arms around them and brought them into their home. I thought that was really, really special. So let's talk about collaboration, right? It's one thing that you love. It's and I want to know why. Why collaboration? Asked me this in my episode, but I want to hear your take on it.
So I think for me it's a combination of insecurity and also fascination. So insecure from the perspective that it wasn't until the ARIA nomination, after the ARIA nomination, was the first time I've ever referred to myself as a musician, ever to anyone on the planet. It's the first time I ever have stopped and gone, I think I can say I'm a musician now. Look, we can deep dive into that, but I don't think it's too complex. It's just because that's what I mean by the insecurity of it. Because I play guitar is my main instrument, but I'm not an amazing player. I've done a Bachelor of Music, and I still, you know, if you ask me to play 1-4-5 in B, I'd still have to draw out a keyboard and go, that's one and two and that's four, and then that's an oh, and that'd be a minor, isn't it? Because it's the two, you know, like it's just so slow for me. And it's not necessarily that I lament not really learning it, but I get such extraordinary joy and kind of this weird a really warming jealousy when I see good people do good stuff. And I don't think it's any more complicated than that. I just get such a – I remember when I lived in China and I went to see an orchestra because I became friends with a girl there that was studying music, and she played the pipa. And she said, do you want to come and watch this orchestra? And I don't think it was a Beijing orchestra, but it was a pretty big one. And I went and watched them. And just, I was hearing this music that I'd heard a million times before, you know, fairly standard pieces, but just played with instruments that I'd never seen. And for people that know me, I own all these random instruments that I can't play, but I'm so in love with the idea of all these things. And I think that's what the collaboration is it's a combination of just going, why can't I? There's no reason why I can't. There really is, like there's that Samoan choir on the Turtle song. There's no reason why I can't. I'm just going to have to go and work it out. And imagine how amazing that is going to be when you get to listen to that. And, you know, I think it's the collaboration for me. I also get an enormous thrill when people say yes. It means the world to me. It's like, it's really validating for me for some reason. I feel so accomplished when people want to be part of something I've done.
That was so great.
Oh, someone's at the door.
Who is it?
It's Justine Clark.
Hi, Justine.
Oh, hi, everyone.
What brings you here?
Well, I was just passing by and overheard what you were doing. I love it.
Just using do, then la, beautiful. But you know what? You can use lots of other different sounds. It's actually called scatting.
Scatting?
Yeah, it's basically using any sounds you'd like. Perhaps I could show you.
Please do.
Like, I think, yeah, I've got a really dear friend. Well, I say dear friend just because, I'd lift a bus off him if it needed somebody with superhuman strength. But it's not like I see him all the time, but he plays the tar. His name's Hamed Sadeghi, and he plays the tar and the oud on a lot of my stuff.
Yeah, of course you did.
Yeah. And I only really see him once a year when something comes up. But I'm such a fan of what he can do. And then, watching at that show at the WOW Festival recently when Claudia was over and, doing the Echidna song with Angie. And I can't do that. I can't do it. I cannot do those harmonies. And to watch someone else do it. But that's the thing. I guess I just kind of go, there's no reason why my music can't have it, but I need to just accept the fact that I can't do it. I think that's what collaboration is for me. It's the fear of just, as I said, the insecurity going, I don't really know how to do that stuff, so I need someone else to do it. But I fall so deeply in love with other people's capabilities.
That is very clear, Benny.
And it's so thrilling. And it just means so much when someone says yes. Like, it just means so much. And that was part of this new album, of just having this band that I just would never ever imagine I would have people like this playing my choosing. Like, they're choosing to do it. Everyone's got an option not to do it. And they're all choosing to do it. And that's, I don't know, I feel like I need to be really, I need to be desperately respectful of that. I need to be enormously respectful that I'm able to ask people to do things that they want to. And it just makes me a heap better at doing it. I mean, every time anybody turns up to play anything, I learn something. So, yeah, does that sort of answer the question?
Then the little cloud did shut its eyes and let out one big giant sigh. Down came the rain from within its eyes and watered the countryside. It cried, felt real free and felt real light. Took a deep breath and sailed on by, floated through the sky. All the clouds must cry someday. All the clouds must cry someday. Someday it's okay to cry.
I want to go a step further with this, because we've talked about collaboration, and I see now that you are that unifier, and that you're grateful that people want to come and work with you, and I can understand why, because you make great music. But there is a theme that comes through in your albums which really intrigues me, and it's the theme of unity. It's a theme of being together and being stronger and doing things better. Why is that theme so important to you?
I guess like many of us, I can't sit here and say it's been an amazing life. It just hasn't been. And like many of us, I've had to work really, really, really hard to be happy to be a part of it. And I just, I guess, when you spend so much of your life really leaning on the idea of conflict, I guess, angry for a really long time, angry, not a good person, I didn't do anything illegal. I just want to clarify that. I'm not, when I say I wasn't a good person, I wasn't out, you know, burning houses down and things, but you know, just a bore. I was just a bore to be around. I was just angry and cross and all those things. And I think it was so much more important to me to find the conflict and everything. And I guess it's all shifted in the last 5 years, or I guess longer, really. But I guess whatever happened somewhere along the lines is I stopped being obsessed with the conflict and started to see the benefit and value and become obsessed with the partnership. And I think it's important to me because it is literally really important to me. It's not about wanting to make kids see it. And I've never really thought of it, and I appreciate you bringing it up because it kind of makes me feel good to know that it is that subconscious. Because I can't – well, I can. I actually can imagine what life looks like when you don't do that. I can actually have a really crystal clear view. And I just – I can't – I don't know. I can't go back there, I guess. And it's really nice to know that I don't even know that it's happening, that it's just seeping in there because it's not conscious. And I guess that's really what I've worked all these years to get to, is to get to the point where it isn't conscious anymore. Mm. And that's nice. And thank you. I'm really grateful for that. And I think it's only been able to do album. And I think I've only been able to do albums like I've done because of that, because of just finally not going for the bullseye of conflict. So I would say that's probably it.
Lovely. And I just want to encourage you, Benny, saying, you know, like, even though you haven't been doing songs on albums with that theme consciously, it is definitely something that we here in New Zealand know you for as a unifier of industry and musicians. And so I think it's important for you to understand that you wear that badge, whether or not you know it or not. It's very large and shiny. And that's, I think, one of the greatest things I personally appreciate about you is that you're someone who has constantly stood up and said to people, you know, look what happens when we work together. This is the world we can enjoy if we bother to try. So yeah, thank you for that.
I appreciate it. And my pleasure. And I think, you know, being a kid of the 80s and 90s, it was all about, you know, it was frowned upon actually just to be jovial or want to be nice to people. And it was a decades of kind of, it was all about money and, you know, not that I was in the 80s swanning around in a suit, but going back to my job, you know, at the accounting firm, I'm just there going, this is just insane. Why are you asking me? I don't get it. Why do you think I'd be good at this? And I don't know, maybe they did because I was angry all the time. And they went, he'll be the perfect destructor of you know, potential competition. I don't know. But yeah, and I think we're just in a bit of a different world now. Like I think people are just more open to it. And it's just an easier sell. Anyway, yeah, sorry, I just drifted off then, trying to work out A, what I was talking about, and B what I was going to have for lunch. But
it's good. Yeah. I feel like we went on a deep dive. There was a moment there for a moment where you sort of went silent, and I thought, "Hey, it's falling into new territory. Let's go." Good, Benny. We went there. It's good.
If you'd like to know more about me, Benny, then head along to bennytime.com or, of course, head on over to episode 2. And, of course, for more Chris goodness, head along to chrislamsam.com. Thanks for joining me, Benny, on Chris Asking Benny Questions.